I can turn the table.
Now I can. That's right. All right, let's go back to Perek Yud Aleph. We started looking at the dialogue between Yiftach and Melech Bnei Amon last week. And that's the. I want to go back to that dialogue. Today we spent last week a little bit going through a little of the historical background to the story. The Israel's conquest of the lands of Sichon, which had originally been territory of Moab, and Sichon had conquered it from Moab, so when Israel came and conquered it from Sichon, there was no real engagement at that time between Israel and Ammon, Moab, or Edom, and that was very clear in Sefer Devarim. And now, 300 years later, Yiftach comes and he opens up a dialogue with Ammon, and with Melech Bnei Ammon, and the response he gets is, "You're sitting in my land," says Melech Bnei Ammon. So let's go back to that conversation. What I want to do is I want to reread the dialogue between Ammon and Melech Bnei Ammon and Yiftach today, now that we have the background, with a little bit more of a critical eye. And there are two issues that I want to look at. One is just to understand the negotiation or the discussion. What are the issues that are being raised here? Yeah, Yiftach makes a number of counter-arguments to Melech Bnei Ammon. And it's worthwhile just taking a look and separating them out, understanding exactly what Melech Bnei Ammon, what Yiftach is suggesting, because it's actually a very interesting lesson in diplomacy. And not that Yiftach is known as a diplomat, but it's a very interesting lesson in diplomacy nonetheless. So let's take a look at it. Vayishlach Yiftach malachim el melech bnei Ammon lemor, ma livalach ki vata ilai li lachem ba'artzi. Pasuk Yud Bet. First delegation that Yiftach sends opens with a statement, general question, ma livalach ki vata ilai lachem ba'artzi. What do you want with me? You come to fight my, take my land, to conquer my territory. What are you doing here? First of all, just in general, why does Yiftach send this delegation in the first place? You've got the camp of Ammon sitting on his doorstep, the drums of war beating. You've got the two armies opposite each other, waiting. Right? We had that from the very, very, very beginning. Why doesn't he just go to war? Ammon is already fighting. They're already conquering territory. Why doesn't he just start the battle?
He wants to see if they can make a deal, arrange some sort of negotiation.
Possibly.
Why else would he send the other way he tell Messier would be to intimidate the... they're not going to intimidate.
No, he doesn't sound like in this moment, he certainly doesn't sound like he's intimidating. Yeah, he's very innocent.
What are we fighting?
What do you need? What are you here for? What's your issue here? What's your beef? And there are several possibilities. Also, there's a halacha. First of all, there's a halacha in the Torah that says that you can't start a war without first extending an arm of peace. And the only exceptions to that, at least on the pshat level of where it seems to be on one level, the only exceptions would be the seven nations of Canaan. And even that's debatable. According to the Rambam and according to the Gemara, even for the seven nations of Canaan, they were required to offer an option of peace. Certainly, they were required to offer an option of peace to nations outside of the seven nations of Canaan, and Ammon is not one of the seven indigenous nations. It's not one of the Shiva Meknaan. They're outside of the boundaries of that box of Eretz Canaan. Second of all, there's a mandate in the Torah itself, we saw it last week when Bnei Yisrael left Mitzrayim, not to start up with and not to engage Ammon, Moab, or Edom. There's a familiar relationship, Edom from Esav, Ammon and Moab from Lot. We don't have any issues with them. Leave them alone. So, really, from that perspective, if we can resolve this thing peacefully, Ammon, go back to your land, we'll stay in our land and live happily ever after. Matov v'manayim. That would certainly be best. It may also be a function of the fact that Yiftach, despite the fact that he's a warrior and despite the fact that he's got a band of soldiers that are loyal to him. He's still fighting against an organized army of Melech Bnei Amon. They still have the disadvantage, outnumbered. And so it could very well be that he just feels that he'd better off finding a peaceful resolution to this than a military one. Maybe. Be that as it may, Melech Bnei Amon responds in a way that Yiftach can't let go. Vayomer Melech Bnei Amon amalachei Yiftach, ki lakach Yisrael et arzi ba'aloto mimitzrayim, me'arnon va'ad hayabok va'ad hayarden. Israel stole our land. Between the Yabok and the Yarden, and between the Arnon and the Yabok, till the Yarden, it was ours. And you are sitting in our land. You want peace? Give us back our land.
How many years intervened?
300 and something. We'll see that. He says so. That's one of the arguments that Yiftach counters. He says, where were you for 300 years?
All of a sudden.
Right, all of a sudden. Land for peace.
Sound familiar?
Very familiar. Vayosef od Yiftach. So Yiftach responds a second time. And now things get a little more dicey. Vayishlach malachim el melech bnei Amon sends a second delegation. Vayomer lo ko amar Yiftach. We already said last week, ko amar Yiftach is a very different kind of introductory introduction then ma lemor ma livalach. Malachim came before, vayishlach malachim amelach bnei Amon lemor. Now it's vayishlach malachim amelach bnei Amon lemor ko ama Yiftach. This is much more assertive. This is right. Don't think you're dealing with a lightweight. Lo lakach Yisrael et eretz Moav et eretz Bnei Amon. You've got it all wrong. We didn't take your land. Now Yiftach's going to teach Melech Bnei Amon a history lesson. Ki ba'alotam mimitzrayim vayelech Yisrael b'midbar ad yamsuf v'yavo kadesha. And Mitzrayim came up from Mitzrayim. When Israel came up from Mitzrayim, they went through the desert. They came to Kadesh, Vayishlach Yisrael Malachim Amelech Edom Lemor. Remember, we were in the south. We sent a delegation to Edom. Ebana be'aretzecha. We just want to pass through. V'lo shema Amelech Edom. V'gam Amelech Moav shalach. V'lo ava. He didn't let. We sent messengers to Melech Moav. He didn't let us go through. Vayishav Yisrael b'Kadesh. Vayelech b'midbar. Vayasav b'deretz Edom b'deretz Moav. We went to circumvent the whole region around Eretz Edom, around Eretz Moab. Mm-hmm. And we came from the east, all the way around the land of Moab. We never stepped foot in the land of Moab because the border was Arnon. And at that time we sent a delegation to Sichon, king of Emori, who was sitting in Cheshbon. We want to go through your land. By the way, here's a much better map to see the places that we're talking about. This is I didn't think of you this map last week. The advantage of this map, the other side is the same map I gave you, but I actually put a different map on the front of it. The advantage of this map is that this is the map of what the region looked like before Israel came through. In other words, 300 years ago, when Israel was walking through the region, this is what the map looked like. Sort of. I wasn't called Midbar Yehuda, but anyway. Yam HaMelech in the center. To the left is what we call today Midbar Yehuda, this area here. And if you look on this big map here, you'll see here it says Moab, and here it says Amon, because this is all orange. But again, in this region, Moab, Mamlechet Edom is in the south, then Moab sits Vadi al-Chasa up to Arnon, Sichon from Arnon to the Yabok, and Amon, Midian, and all of those tribes to the right. the big black line through the center is a road called
Derech HaMelech.
Or King's Highway.
King's Highway, correct. That's right. The King's Highway. You may even find Barnes Jewish over there. I don't know. Who knows? Back to our story. Vayishlach Yisrael Melechim al Sichon Melech Amorim Melech Heshbon. So we sent the message to Sichon, and we said to him, Nabba Nabi Artzachad Mokomi, Velo Emin Sichon et Yisrael Avor Bikvulo. Sichon wouldn't let us go through. Vayasof Sichon et Kol Amo. Vayachanu B'Yatza. Sichon gathered his army to fight in Yatza. Take a look at the map. Where is Yatza? Right. Yatza is kind of a jumping point into Eretz Sichon. We came up through, if you can see on the map which says Nachal Zared, we came up, because we weren't around Eretz Edom and around Eretz Moab, we came up through Nachal Zared, and from the Arnon went into the north region of Eretz Sichon. So Sichon's army is encamped at Yatza, and we're in the Arnon, and they're going to engage each other in the middle. Vayilachem im Yisrael. Vayiten Hashem Elokei Yisrael et Sichon v'et kol amo b'yad Yisrael. God gave Sichon and his people into the hands of Israel. Vayakum v'yirash Yisrael et kol eretz ha'emori yoshev ha'aretz ha'hi. We conquered and gained the territory of Melech Ha'emori, by the name of Sichon. Vayirshu et kol gvula emori me'arnon ve'ad ayabok u'min ha'midbar ve'ad yarde. We took the entire region from the Arnon to the Yabok to the Midbar, from the Midbar to the Yarden. You can see the box. Arnon in the south, the Yabok in the north, the Yarden in the left, or the west. What's marked on the map is Ramat Bnei Amon, which stays as the capital of Amon, because that Derech HaMelech becomes the. Yes. And here's Ramat Bnei Amon. Okay, so that becomes the border. Cheshbon, these cities, Yatza is over here. Right? Our area, Yatza. Mm-hmm. What you're looking at is a blown up map of this region here. So you're mm-hmm. It's right. A little bit. Okay. Mm-hmm. Pasuk Chav Gimel, V'ata Hashem Elokei Yisrael Orisha Te'amorim Yipnei Amo Yisrael. God of Israel removed the Amorites and gave their land to Israel. V'ata Tirashenu, and you are going to come and take it away from us and take this land from us? Halo at Asher Yorishcha Kmo Shaloecho Oto Tirash. V'at Asher V'at Kol Asher Horish Hashem Elokeinu Mipaneinu Oto Nirash. You can keep the land that Kamosh, your God, gave you, and we'll keep the land that Hashem, our God, gave us. Are you any better than Balak ben Zippor, king of Moab, who strove with Israel, fought with Israel? B'shevet Yisrael b'cheshbon u'vivnoteh u'v'aror u'vivnoteh v'chol ha'arim asher al yedei Arnon 300 shana. We've been sitting in Cheshbon and Aroer and all of the cities. They're on the map, right? Cheshbon, Medva, Aroer, all those cities between the Arnon and the Yabok. We've been sitting in that region for 300 years. U'madu lo itzaltem b'etahi. Where were you for 300 years? Why didn't you come earlier? V'anochi lo chatati lach. I didn't do anything to you. You wage war against me? Yishpot Hashem ha-shofet hayom ben b'nei Yisrael u'ven b'nei Amon. God will be the judge between you and us. That's the speech. So we're going to do an interesting little exercise now. And that is, we're going to go back. I'm going to give you a few minutes on your own to reread it. It's an exercise that Nechama Leibowitz used to drill into us all the time. I do it with my students. I haven't done it here, but maybe I should do it a little more often. Take a step back, read it again on your own, divide it up. If you want to write it down, you can write it down. Divide it up. How many different arguments does Yiftach put forward to defend Israel's position? How many distinct, different political or diplomatic arguments does Yiftach put forward? It's an amazing speech, because if you start to divide it and you start to think about the different approaches he's taking, it actually divides up into several, more than several, different units. It's not one speech, or it's not one message. Think in terms of modern terms of diplomacy. He'd give a course in political science in the speech. And the arguments are sequential, meaning he doesn't they're not interspersed one side or the other. It goes from one straight into the other. So how many have we come up with so far?
Five.
All right, let's see what you have. Let's start from the beginning.
First one I have is that with the first time when he sent messages, there's no basis for a war between Israel and Ammo.
Okay. Just a general statement. What are you doing here? Mali Valach. I wasn't including that, but that's fine. Okay, what's next?
The second one I have is that Israel didn't take away land from Ammon. When they weren't granted permission to go through, they went around Ammon.
Okay, so that starts Pasuk Tetvav, Goma Yiftach, and goes through. Where does that argument stop and the next argument begin?
I have a separate argument that they traveled around Ammon and Moab rather and respected their territory. Now that may be the same.
Yeah, I would have put that together because that's part of what we're going to call the historical revisionism argument. Ammon, you've got right. Sichon is already
separate.
A different issue. Sichon is a different issue because he's not. This isn't Sichon. He's talking to. He's talking to Melech Bnei Ammon. So the first issue, I think, correct, right? That's correct. The first issue starts in Pasuk Tetvav and goes through, let's say, Pasuk Yudchet. You could possibly include your Tet too, but let's say Pasuk Yudchet. And what is the argument there? Ammon's declaration of war starts with Israel stole our land. Israel stole our land. When you came out of Egypt, you stole our land. So the first thing Yiftach does is set the record straight. You've got a little bit of historical revisionism. You need to relearn your history. We never touched your land. What are you talking about? We went all the way around Edom. We went all the way around Moab. We never came anywhere near your land. All we dealt with was Sichon. You're not Sichon. Sichon has an issue. Sichon will come to us. You're not Sichon. The land was originally yours? That's true. It is true that the land was originally yours. But it had been conquered by Sichon. How do you come to us to claim land that was taken from you by Sichon? You've got an issue. Go take it up with Sichon. Well, Sichon's dead for 300 years. That's not my problem.
Why now?
We'll get to that. That's the last piece. But that's the first argument, which I think is a classic example of just the history of it. There's a complete distortion of the facts on the ground. That wasn't meant to be a pun. Who took the land from whom? So he goes back to Parshat Chukat and reviews the story. That's part one. Part two, Yetet through What's the second argument? Where you divide the next section is going to determine what the next argument is.
Then we offered peace to Sichon.
Yeah. And?
They refused.
And they refused. And the purpose of including that information, this has got nothing to do with Yiftach, with Bnei Amon. Bnei Amon wasn't part of that discussion. This is Sichon. This is that was with Sichon. That was with Emori. This is Bnei. Why is that
they
relevant?
To prove the point that they're going out of their way not to engage these other countries, that they just wanted to get to Israel.
They just wanted to get to Israel, and therefore, if there was a war,
they tried to avoid it.
It was.
It was not instigated by Israel.
It wasn't instigated by us.
Right.
We were not the instigators. The declaration that Yiftach made was Lakach Yisrael et Artzi. Lakach Yisrael et Artzi ba'alotom Mitzrayim. We took your land. We didn't take anybody's land. We did not only did we not take your land because you weren't even there, it wasn't even your territory, it was Sichon's territory, argument number one. Number two, we didn't take Sichon's territory either. All we wanted to do was walk through. Sichon came out to us. V'lo ha'emin Sichon yishol avo b'gvulo. We wouldn't let us through. V'yesof Sichon et kol amo v'yachnu v'yatza v'yilachem im Yisrael. He fought with us. He came to us. With the soldiers and his army and his chariots came running. We had to defend ourselves. Are you going to hold us accountable because we were good at defending ourselves? In the end, Sichon lost the battle. When you wage a war, you take a risk.
Yeah, but
and the risk is
you lose.
If you lose,
but the other argument is if you're going to Israel, then why? On what he could come back to? Well, then why did you hold on to this land across the Jordan?
So there's two counters to that. Number one, because that's the way the rules of war work.
If you conquer,
then you're victorious, and you get to keep the land. There's a theological argument there, which is going to make in a moment. But before we get to the theological argument, that is true even up to modern times. The rule of the Geneva Convention is that in a war of self defense, if the aggressor loses, the defender gets to keep the territory. The whole argument about the Six-Day War is only because the argument in international. The only rational argument is that Israel fired the first shot, depending on how you look at the events of the Six-Day War. Depending on what you see as an act of war, if the closing of the Straits of Tehran. Was an act of war, then we didn't fire the first shot. But if you look at the first actual ammunition fired, Israel fired the first shot. Therefore, they could argue it's a war of aggression. So even until modern times, that the distinction between a war of self-defense and a war of aggression is very clear. And in the Torah, it's also clear that there's a distinction to be made between a war of self-defense and a war of aggression. And the argument against Sichon was that it was a war of self-defense. We were walking through. He came out to us, started up with us, and in that context, he lost. So he lost his land. But that's not an argument with you, Melech Bnei Amon. That's with Sichon.
But it kind of went, I guess when they fought, it took over Sichon. I mean, Amon's lands too?
No, just Sichon's land. Between the Arnon and the Yabok, between the Midbar and the Yarden. Just Eretz Sichon. Now, it happened to be that Eretz Sichon had previously belonged to Moab. That is true. But that's irrelevant now. We're coming. Argument number two. So I think argument number two would be that this was a war of self-defense, not of the war of aggression. Psukim Yutet and Chaf. Argument number three.
Anything about it for 300
years. That's, I think, arguing for.
We won.
We won, and therefore?
So therefore we were there legitimately.
Okay, that's part of the war of self-defense argument, I think.
Okay.
But follow along those lines. There's, look at the next set of psukim. Chaf Aleph, Chaf Bet, Chaf Gimel, Chaf Dalet. Ten Hashem Elokei Yisrael et Sichon v'et kol amo b'yad Yisrael v'yakum Vayirashi Yisrael et kol eretz amuri yoshev haaretz ahi. Vayishu et kol gvule emori me'anon v'adei abok min the midbar v'adei yarden. V'ata Hashem olokei Yisrael orish et amuri mipnei amo Yisrael v'ata tirashenu. Alot asher yirishcha k'mosh elohecha oto tirash. V'ata asher horish Hashem olokeinu mipaninu oto nirash.
Right. This is the first time he's mentioning Hashem.
Correct. This is where he introduces a theological component. First time he mentions God. First time he b'chlal even mentions God's name.
You don't see his name in it.
Correct. Before this, you don't find God's name at all. Yiftach is a warrior like it. From the rank and file. The argument here, however, is a very compelling one in the world of Tanakh. It would hold less sway in the halls of the United Nations today, maybe. Well, that depends on which nation you ask. But in the world of Tanakh, which perceived a deity attached to every nationality and to every country. Every nation had its identifiable deity. That goes all the way back to the world of Yetziat Mitzrayim, where we 2 weeks before Pesach, so it's an appropriate conversation to have. It goes all the way back to the story of Makot Mitzrayim, where the war between God and Paro revolved around the icons of Egyptian theology. Icons such as the Nile, such as Paro himself, such as the sun. All three recognized known deities or religious icons in the world of Mitzrayim. And if you look at the plagues, there's a clear agenda to direct the plagues at each of those deities, as if to say, in the mindset of Paro, this war is between my God and your God. And may the stronger God win. Right? That's not because the Torah gives credence to the deities of other nations fighting each other, but in the language that Paro could understand, his opening declaration is Mi Hashem Esher Shema B'Kolo, who is this God that I should listen to him? So Moshe says to him, I'll show you. And between the first three plagues that hit the Nile and the next three plagues that hit the Egyptians, and the next three plagues that hit the sky and the sun, and all three of them, Arba, Ebarad, Arba, and Choshech, blocked out the sun, Vatachshach Haaretz, the whole agenda of, and then Makat Bechorot, of course, which is directed specifically at Paro, the whole message of the plagues was an educational agenda to address the theology of Mitzrayim. The notion that if a conquering nation is victorious, it's because their God is stronger than the other, is part of the religious world in which the nations came from. And Yiftach's keenly aware of that argument. He may even believe it. In other words, he may believe both halves of it. Not clear. He certainly believes that if God gave us our land, then it belongs to us. Whether he believes that if Kamosh gave you your land, then it belongs to you, I'm not sure. That remains to be seen. But he certainly mounts an argument that recognizes the theological power of each region national deity. Hashem Elokei Yisrael et Asher Pasuk of Dalet. It's an amazing pasuk. Halo et Asher Yorishcha Kamosh Elohecha Otot Tirash. You can take the land that Kamosh gave you, and we'll take the land that Hashem gave us. If you come against our land, if you challenge our conquest, then you are fighting not only me, but you are fighting Hashem. You want to start up with Hashem? Historically, that doesn't bode well. That, I think, is argument number three. What comes next? Chafei and Chavav.
300 years, so you haven't done anything about it.
Right. before he gets to 300 years. V'yata ha'tov tov atam mi'balak ben tzipor melech Moav. Why does he go back to Balak?
He's giving an example.
Yeah.
Of
a theological argument.
Yes.
You think you're going to
get... What happens if you strive against Israel? Hashem is going to take
care of you. You're going to get as far as Balak got. Not very far.
Okay, that's part of it. Certainly Balak was unsuccessful at dealing with Israel. But Balak had a very interesting approach. Did Balak open war with Israel?
No.
No. No. Balak was Melech
Moab.
Balak ben Zippor Melech Moab. He was the king. If anybody would have had an argument against the conquest of Israel in that territory, it would have been Moab. And yet Balak's response was not to come and fight us and say, hey, you took our land. It was to hire Bilam and try to curse us.
And also with the...
And Benot Midian, which is not really part of the conversation here. In other words, at least in the perspective of the military conquest, Balak made peace, if you will, in some way, with the fact that we were there. We took that land. So I think the reference to Balak is a kind of a recognition, by de facto recognition, Balak, who was Melech Moav, never fought with us. Harov Rabim Yisrael and Mechom Nilchamban, did he come and fight with us? Did he come and take this, try to take this land back? No, because he recognized that we took it from Sichon and not from Moav.
So that's
part of that historical recognition. And if he recognized it, so now 300 years later, you're going to come and undermine that which was already given international recognition by the nations at the time. For 300 years we've been sitting here. Where have you been? Sitting and sleeping? So from the days of Balak till today, nobody has challenged our claim or right to this land. Suddenly it's your land?
He gave it acceptance.
De facto, de facto recognition, absolutely. And then, of course, his final argument, which is Pasuk of Zion. V'anochi lo chatati lach. V'ata osei iti ra'ali lachim bi. What's the argument? I've done nothing to you. You come to fight with me. What's the argument?
He's repeating the first thing he said in a different way.
He is repeating a little bit, but he's adding a little bit of a sharpness.
Right.
What's the sharpness? He's already he's debunked the historical argument. He's debunked the argument of aggression. He's debunked the argument of international recognition. So what's left to Sichon, to Melech Ben Amon's claim?
That he has a current grievance.
Yeah, man, I have a current grievance. So he says, you don't even know who I am, right? I'm a nobody to you. Ma'achatatilach, what have I done to you? You come to fight with me. There's no local grievance. In other words, the whole thing's a pretense. The whole thing is a pretense to war. There's not a single legitimate political, diplomatic argument that you can raise that we could take to the halls of the Security Council and give it legitimacy. Everything's a pretense. You want to fight with who? You want to fight? We'll fight. But be careful what you wish for. Because we're not going to go down quietly. Yishpot Hashem HaShofet Bayom Ben B'nei Yisrael Uvein B'nei Amon. God will be the judge. And let the better man win. And that's his final argument. His final argument is, this is all a pretense to war. You want to start? Isn't it? But God will be the judge. So, I count five distinct arguments that Yiftach puts forward to counter the claim that we stole their land. Dialogue, diplomacy, back and forth, and in the end, V'lo shema melech ben Amon al divrei Yiftach, didn't hear any of it, it all fell on deaf ears, and the war starts. Fatia Yiftach ruach Hashem, ve'avoyet ha'gilad, the war starts. And that's where we go from here. Okay. So only one issue in this entire argument that Yiftach has put forward. And it's an issue, I don't know if we raised it here last week or not. One of the two classes it was raised. I don't remember which. Apologies. It's one of the problems of giving the same show twice. And that Yiftach's argument is directed at the wrong people. It's a beautiful argument. It's well constructed. It's well crafted. It's the wrong argument. From the word go, it's the wrong argument. Why?
Because it's not directed at Moab, it's directed at Ammon.
Correct. He's talking to Moab. But the war is with Ammon. The whole basis of this argument is about Moab. And Moab comes up in this speech several times, at every level. But this war is with Ammon, not with Moab. You have to wonder what's going on here.
So Sihon, I mean, the king of Ammon says, what is that, you know, I want this territory. Whatever you said about Moab doesn't apply.
It doesn't apply to me. What are you talking to me for? The whole thing is, it's so absurd that it needs an answer, because it can't be that he missed the mark. And he's talking to Melech and Ammon, oops, I meant to say Ammon, I was only talking about... I mean, just look at the number of times and places in which Moab is the center of the conversation. And go through the arguments again. Let's go start with the historical argument. Back to Pasuk Tetvav. Koma Yiftach. Lo lakach Yisrael et Eretz Moav et Eretz Bnei Ammon. Who brought Moab into the picture? Ki bolotam mi Mitzrayim v'yelech Yisrael b'midbar yansuf v'yovel kadesha v'yishlach Yisrael malachim v'melech Edom. Let's go through the land of Edom. No. We sent messengers to Melech Moav. Again, where did Moav come into the picture? Pasuk Yudchet, we went all the way around Eretz Edom. We went all the way around Eretz Moav. We came east of Moav so that we could go through the Arnon. Pasuk Yudchet at the end of the Pasuk, Velo Bao Bigvul Moav. We never stepped foot in the land of Moav. Ki Arnon Gvul Moav. Arnon was the border with Moav. Ah, you say we took your land? The land that we took belonged to Sihon. And Sihon had conquered it previously from?
Oh.
No.
Oh.
Sihon had conquered it previously from?
Moab.
Oh. The whole battle between Sihon and was over the land of Moab. That, if you go back to the Psukim in Bamidbar, in Perek, in Parashat Chukat, Perek Chav Aleph, Pasuk Chav Vav. Starting with Pasuk Chav Daled. Vayakeo Yisrael Lefichareth. We conquered Sichon. Vayirashet Arzo. We took the land of Sichon. Me Arnon Ad Yabok. Again, that's the border from the Arnon River to the Yabok River. Ad Bnei Ammon. Until the border with Ammon. Ki az gvu b'nei Ammon. The border with Ammon was strong. Vayikach Yisrael et kol harim ha'ele. We took these cities. Vayeshiv Yisrael b'chol harei ha'amori b'cheshbon v'chol v'noteha. We sat. The capital of the region was Cheshbon. Ki Cheshbon ir Sichon melech ha'amorihi. Cheshbon was now an Amorite city belonging to Sichon. Vehu nilcham b'melech Moav harishon v'yikach et kol arzo miyado ad hayar Arnon. And Sichon had previously conquered it from melech Moav from the Arnon unto the Yabok. And the rest of the poem is all about Moav. Pasuk Chavchet. Ki eish yetzah mi'cheshbon le'ava mi'kiyat Sichon achla ar Moav ba'alei bamot Arnon. Oy lecha Moav avad ta'am kmosh. Kmosh is the deity of Moab. So, I'm missing something. Right? The whole historical argument, the argument of historical revisionism, falls to the ground. It falls away. The moment you realize we're talking to Bnei Ammon, not to Moab. And he does it again when he mentions all of the cities. Pasuk Havav. B'shevet Yisrael b'cheshbon uvivnoteh, b'ar or uvivnoteh, v'chol arim asher ad, asher ha'yedei Arnon, 300 shana. We sat in all these cities, Cheshbon and Aroer. They were all Moabite cities taken from Sichon. None of them had anything to do with Ammon. The biggest blunder Yiftach makes, the biggest blunder, is in the identity of the deity. Because he mentions specifically Kmosh. And I'll show you something very interesting. Something very interesting. Take a look in Melachim Aleph. The deities of the nations are mentioned in various places in Tanakh. In Melachim Aleph, Perek Yud Aleph, Shlomo Melech, at the end of his life, with all of his wives and all of his political alliances and cultural integration, is multiculturalism, to quote a relevant topic, finds that this multiculturalism leads him directly into the depths of idolatry and a one-way street to you-know-where. Pasuk Zayin, Az Yivne Shlomo Bama Lich. Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Zayin. So, Shlomo begins to allow to be built various temples and altars to different deities. I have a whole list of them now. As Yivne Shlomo Bama L'Kmosh Shikutz Moav, Kmosh is the deity of Moav, Baharu Asher B'nei Yerushalayim, Ulemolech Shikutz B'nei Amon. I have two very distinct deities. Kmosh is the god of Moab, and Molech is the god of Ammon. Sometimes it's called Molech, sometimes it's called Milcom, but essentially it's the same. I'm astounded by the blunder of this conversation. There's another mystery in the story. And we're going to resolve all of these mysteries with one suggestion. But the other mystery is, if we go back to Shoftim and go back to the beginning of the story, starting with Pasuk Zayin. Perek Yud, Pasuk Zayin. We're going back to the previous parak. Vayichraf Hashem b'Yisrael vayimkirem b'yad plishtim uv'yad b'nei Amon. Remember, that was our introduction. Vayiratzu vayiratzatzu et b'nei Yisrael b'shana ha'hi shmona asrei shana et kol b'nei Yisrael asher be'ever ha'yardein be'eretz ha'mori asher b'gilad. They oppressed and distressed Israel for 18 years, dwelling on the east side of the Yarden. Vayavu b'nei Amon et ha'yardein. Lilachem gam b'Yehuda uve'Binyamin uve'Beit Efrayim. They crossed the Yarden to fight against Yehuda, Binyamin, and Ephraim. Ve'avru b'nei Amon et ha'Yarden lilachem gam b'Yehuda gam uve'Binyamin uve'Beit Efrayim v'teitza li'Yisrael ma'od v'yizaku b'nei Yisrael, etc. And then the war begins. And the war begins in Mitzpeh, Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vayitzaku b'nei Amon v'yachnu b'Gilad v'yasu b'nei Yisrael v'yachnu b'mitzpah. So I have two mysteries in this story. Two very strange phenomena. Here is Amon. According to the way the story is described, they oppress Israel in the east of the Yarden for 18 years. Vayavu et ha'yarden, they cross over the Yarden, and they begin to distress whom?
Yehuda, Binyamin, and Ephraim.
Yehuda, Binyamin, and Ephraim. What's odd?
South.
They cross the Yarden.
What's odd?
Well,
where are they
crossing? No, that they crossed the Yarden.
Well, they would have to cross the Yarden get to Yehuda, Binyamin, and Ephraim.
That wasn't territory that they were.
So they're encroaching. That's another part of the argument which Yiftach doesn't address,
right,
which is, if your issue is about land, so why did you cross the Yarden?
Right.
It could be that Yiftach crossed the Yarden. It could be that Bnei Amon crossed the Yarden because they wanted negotiating room. Right. We'll take 200% of what we want, so that when we negotiate, you'll give us back 100% of what we want, and you can take the other half, right? It's negotiating group. But they cross over. But look at the region. Look at the geography. They cross over. Lilachem b'Yehuda, b'Binyamin, u'b'Ephraim.
It's pretty spread out.
It's pretty spread out, but it's also backwards. If you cross the, if you're here, Ammon, and you cross the Yarden, you get the Ephraim first, then Binyamin, then Yehuda. How do you get to Yehuda, Binyamin, and Ephraim first?
Well, they're all together.
Number one. Number two, the war ultimately is centered here in Ramat Gilad.
So how do they go back?
Why is the army here?
Maybe they just raided that area, then they didn't want to stay there.
How does Ammon cross the Yarden without going through Eretz Gilad? The war is here. How did the army of Ammon get to this region if the war front is still here in the Gilad?
Did they go down to Kadesh?
Did they go down to Kadesh?
No, I'm just saying that
or
we
did they go down to? Or did they go down to? Moab. If I start from Moab, if Yiftach's talking to Moab, not to Ammon, then they cross the Yarden.
That makes sense.
And they go to Yehuda, Binyamin, and Ephraim.
That makes sense.
And it makes much more sense.
Cross the Dead Sea?
Yeah.
You can cross the Dead Sea. That's not hard to do. Or you can cross south beneath it.
Yeah, but you can't cross the Yarden.
It's Nachal Zaret.
Yeah.
Evut Yarden, I think, is a... From every perspective, I'm confused. And there's really only one solution. There's only one solution. It's a theory which is written up in an article which appears in one of the periodicals on Tanakh called Megadim.
Is it possible that at that point Edom and Ammon had conquered Moab and Moab and Ammon were like one nation?
Right. That's the only solution. That at this period of time, Ammon and Moab are really one nation. Remember that Ammon and Moab have a common history.
Yeah, right.
And they're virtually always mentioned together. There's even a link between Ammon and Moab and Stom v'Amora. We talked about that before. The link between Ammon and Moab and Stom and Amora. Something I remember. Maybe Megillat will too. But Shavuos night, who remembers what we do Shavuos night? 3 o'clock in the morning. Maybe next year when we go back to this beginning of the year, we'll do a subunit on Megillat Ruth because it's relevant to the time period. But there are strong connections between Ammon and Moab and Stom v'Amora. Geographically, Stom v'Amora is exactly where Eiver HaYarden is, the northeast bank of the Dead Sea. Was the original territory of Ammon and Moab on the east side of the Yarden. That's where Lot chose Arei HaKikar. That's the five cities that were destroyed. And remember that that Ammon and Moab are born from Lot as the legacy of the destruction of their cities. Ish ein ba'aretz levo aleinu, say the daughters of Lot. There's nobody left to populate the world with. And everybody assumes that that means that they were looking at the world that the world is coming to an end. But if you remember the story, they had asked for refuge in the city of Tsoar. There were five Arei HaKikar, Stom, Amora, Admat, Tzvoyim, and Tsoar. Lot had asked the Malach to spare the city of Tsoar so that they could escape. And he granted their wish. So they come to the city of Tsoar, which means that there's one of the five cities that's not being destroyed. They can see that east of the Arden, Gafrit v'Melech, there's salt and there's fire and brimstone. West of the Arden, the sun is shining. What is it? Why would they have perceived that the world was coming to an end if Stom v'Amora was being destroyed? And if the fifth city of the Arei HaKikar was being spared and all of Eretz Yisrael was being spared? The only real answer is that they weren't worried about the rest of humanity being destroyed. They were worried about the legacy of Stom v'Amora being destroyed. The Chacham Leibowitz in Yonim points out that in Tanakh, the term for relations between men and women is Lavo El. There's only one place, actually two places in all of Tanakh, where the relation between a man and a woman is described as levo al, and it's in the mitzvah of Yibum, where the levirate marriage, where the brother remarries the widow in order to establish the seed of the deceased husband, the ish levo al. When the daughters of Lot say to each other, "Ish en ba'aretz lavo aleinu," what they really mean to say is, "There's nobody left from the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. We are the last survivors of Sodom and Gomorrah." The mandate of Yibum, in its philosophical sense, which is to reestablish the seed of the nation that was lost, is now incumbent upon us. Lot and Ammon and Moab were born, therefore, to reestablish the legacy of Sodom and Gomorrah. Which is why the geographic location of Ammon and Moab is in the region of Sodom v'Amorah, and why it also explains a very strange pasuk in the Torah. When the Torah says that no converts are allowed to come from Ammon and Moab for eternity, the phrase in the Torah is that Ammon and Moab lo yavo b'kal Hashem, ad dor asiri lo yavo b'kal Hashem, no converts accepted from Ammon and Moab. Why? Because when you left Egypt, they didn't come greet you with bread and water. Because they weren't hospitable. Because they weren't hospitable, for all eternity, they're outside the pale. This also heard from Rav Meidan. It's not that just that they weren't hospitable. It's that Ammon and Moab represent the legacy of Sodom and Gomorrah. So if Mitzrayim's inhospitable, or Aram or Ashur inhospitable, so they're inhospitable. When Ammon and Moab are inhospitable, that's called being a repeat offender. That's the legacy of Sodom v'Amorah all over again. That's the equivalent today of anti-Semitism in Germany versus anywhere else in Europe or the world. It has a very different flavor. And a different reaction or response. And at this point in time, Ammon and Moab go back and forth from being two separate nations to being one united nation, one united group. In Perek Gimel, the first time we conquered them in this Sefer, remember the story of Ehud? Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud Bet. Vayasifu b'nei Yisrael lasot hara b'nei Hashem, vayachazek Hashem et Eglon melech Moav Yisrael, God strengthened the hand of Eglon, king of Moab, vayasof elav et b'nei Ammon v'Amalek. You can't separate Ammon and Moab. It's one nation. King of Moab calls up the army of Ammon. King of Ammon calls up the army of Moab. They're interconnected. So when the king of Ammon comes to Yiftach and he says, Lakach Yisrael et Artsi, he's speaking on behalf of the united kingdom of Ammon and Moab. Later in periods of time, they'll separate. Earlier they may have separated. They go back and forth because they're cousins, because they're so interconnected. But in that regard, in this story, in this period of time right now, Ammon and Moab are perceived as one people. So he's fighting with Melech ben Ammon, but the army, the rank and file, the soldiers, the people, are the people of Moab and Ammon.
And that's why he cites Moab's deity.
That's why the argument is all about Moab. The argument Ammon put forward was about Moab, was about the land taken from Sichon, which was Moab land. So Yiftach responds specifically to the accusation that he was challenged with, which is about the story of Moab. And he's not bothered by the fact that he's talking to Melech ben Ammon, because it's one group. It's one identity. That would also explain how they managed to get into Eretz Yehuda, Binyamin, and Ephraim, and why the war is centered here in the Gilad. Because I've got Ammon and Moab essentially as one battle. It also explains one other piece of information which I'm just going to plant in your minds. I'm going to put it out on the table. We're not going to elaborate on it now. But there's a great deal of discussion about the time frame of Megillat Rut. a great deal of discussion about the time frame of Megillat Rut. Megillat Rut takes place, all it says in the introduction is Vayhi Bimei Shvot HaShoftim, the time of the Shoftim. The time of the Shoftim is over 350 years long. It doesn't give me a very narrow window. And if you remember the story, Elimelech, in the midst of a hunger, a ra'av, a hi ra'av ba'aretz, Elimelech picks himself up and goes to
Moab,
because there's bread in Moab, because there's food in Moab. And God destroys him and his family, and the and what's left is Naomi and Ruth and Orpah. He marries daughters of Moab. The children marry daughters of Moab. The children marry daughters of Moab, and then after it's all done, Naomi comes back with Ruth ha Moavia. So there's a whole discussion as to when that story took place, because it's a mystery. We have no record of a famine in the land of Israel caused by drought during the period of the Shoftim. Vayibimei Shvot HaShoftim comes back. And who's the leader in Beit Lechem? Boaz. So Chazal, in their attempt to try to understand the time frame of Megillat Rut, offer two possible indicators as to when the story takes place. One is the identification of Boaz as Iftsan. Iftsan, if you remember, is the Shofet in Sefer Shoftim from Beit Lechem. Now, we've already established on the level of Pshat, Beit Lechem of Iftsan may be different from Iftsan of Beit Lechem Yehuda, but nonetheless, Chazal identify Boaz with Iftsan. And the second phrase is Vayhi b'mei Shvot HaShoftim. Chazal understood the phrase to mean not just the time that the judges judged, but the time that the judges were judged. Shvot HaShoftim. Meaning, it's a time when the level of depth in the leadership of Israel had stooped to a lowest of a low point. When Chazal want to point to the lowest point in the time of Shoftim, they always point to Yiftach. Shmuel bedaro ke Yiftach bedaro. And if you work backwards from Iftsan is the Shofet in Beit Lechem immediately following Yiftach. If you go to the end of Perikid, middle of Perikid Bet, immediately following Yiftach, Pasuk Chet, Vayishpot Acharav, after Yiftach, Iftsan mi Beit Lechem. How many years does Naomi spend in Eretz Moav? 10. So if she comes back when Iftsan is Boaz slash Iftsan is in Beit Lechem, and she left 10 years earlier, Yiftach is a shofet for 6 years before Iftsan. That means she left when? She left 4 years before the war between Yiftach and Bnei Amon. During what is described here as the 18 years of the oppression of Bnei Amon. What's the significance of all of that? The significance is, and with this, I will conclude, but I need the theory that I just put forward, the thesis, that Amon and Moab is one people. And if Amon and Moab is one people, and if the world of Megillat Rut is taking place in the years prior to the war with Yiftach, it means that the ra'av, the hunger that Megillat Rut speaks about, is not a hunger being caused by drought. It's a hunger or famine being caused by the war with, or the oppression by, Ammon slash Moab. Ammon slash Moab as the enemy for 18 years is oppressing the Jewish people and causing economic hardship and drought and famine in the land of Israel. Now read the beginning of Megillat Rut.
Then it's even worse.
Elimelech picks himself up and goes lagur b'sdei Moav. Why does he go to Sde Moav? Because there's bread. You know why there's bread there? Because they're the winning nation. Because they're in power. Because they're in control. And Elimelech's act of moving to Ammon, to Moab, isn't just a function of going wherever the food is. It's called treason. And it changes the whole nature of the beginning of Megillat Rut. And the dynamic of the story of Naomi's return with Rut HaMoaviyah in the aftermath of the battle of Yiftach and Moab suddenly takes on a whole new color and an understanding of Megillat Rut. I think it's based on an assumption that Ammon and Moab at this period of time is in fact one unified people. We will adjourn here.